Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. The first decade of American government was anything but the grand democratic tableau so dear to popular imagination. It was a raucous, bitter, divisive era marked by vicious argument between those who saw the country's destiny as monarchical and those who espoused popular democracy. Newspapers were a prime battlefield in this war for the country's future. One of them, the Aurora, published in Philadelphia, was celebrated by Thomas Jefferson as having done much to arrest the rapid march of our government toward monarchy. That newspaper, its editors, and the famous and obscure figures who determined the meaning of American liberty are the subjects of Richard Rosenfeld's book, American Aurora. Richard Rosenfeld, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George. I'm delighted to be here.
Richard, the very first sentence of your book reads, "It was a special time in the history of America." I found in those words almost an echo, if you will, of A Tale of Two Cities. It struck me as you were citing this as a very fateful era in our nation's history, and one that, here I ask the question, may have been a debate about the demeaning of American freedom itself.
Well, you know, it was my intention to have the first paragraph of the book echo A Tale of Two Cities, A Tale of Two Cities being a view of the French Revolution from the English point of view, as it was seen by Thomas Carlyle in his History of the French Revolution, this being a history of the American Revolution as well as its time, a view of the French Revolution, if you will, from the point of view of America, of Philadelphia, looking at it through the pages of the leading opposition newspaper at the time, the Philadelphia Aurora.
Mm-hmm. You succeed admirably, let me tell you, as a reader, in taking us back to that time and making us see it from precisely that perspective. And I wanted to ask you a question right at the start about that, Richard. The book has what I call a sawdust quality. That is to say, it is so realistic, you use the dispatches and the accounts, the letters of the time itself, the reader is cast back into the period. That was obviously intentional. What was the reason, though, you chose that method?
Well, I must say, I kind of fell upon the method. Originally, this book was a book about civil liberties. It was going to be a book about the First Amendment, and I went back to examine the Sedition Act of 1798 because I thought that it was very odd that 7 years after the Bill of Rights had been ratified, John Adams would sign and George Washington would support a bill that made it illegal to criticize the President of the United States. In looking at that time, I was struck by a variety of things, including the fact that the principal newspaper they wanted to silence was a newspaper being published by Benjamin Franklin's grandson, Benjamin Franklin Beach. And I found the story of the relationship between Adams and Washington and the Franklins, both Benjamin Franklin and his grandson, to be so dramatic I wanted to try to dramatize it the best way I could, and I began to write historical fiction. But frankly, as I began to write historical fiction, I found that form so unsatisfying, making up the details, that I began to wonder whether or not the newspaper, which after all this was a story of a newspaper, the Philadelphia Aurora, couldn't in fact tell its own story, whether the newspaper couldn't, after all the newspaper was the victim of all these acts of crowds trying to destroy it and all the rest of it, and each day it reported what happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to think whether I couldn't piece together newspaper reports which would tell a story, and then I began to read the opposition papers. The Aurora was published in the morning, and the opposition, and the Federalist papers, the administration papers, were published in the afternoon, and I began to discover between these, among these newspapers, really a colloquy, because the Aurora was published by the grandson, and these other newspapers were published by individuals, and they called each other by name.
Right.
And what I discovered was that there was kind of a personal day-by-day colloquy among these newspaper publishers that could be replicated and could mm-hmm. give one the feeling, a lot of your listeners probably aren't old enough to remember the days of a party line when listening on a telephone and more than one party used
right.
it at the same time, but it had a party line quality. And that began to revivify the period for me, and I think for the reader it does too. The newspaper.
Well, let me just say, as a reader, you succeed admirably in that. It does revivify. In fact, it peoples the past for us. We get a sense of the actual, true historic drama of the period, and no work of fiction could have done it better. One question about this immediately comes to mind. As you point out, the vitriol in these papers and in these arguments was astounding, even by modern standards. There was a lot of ad hominem argument back and forth. And John Adams, as president, was, of course, under attack by the Aurora for his suspected monarchical tendencies. He returned that feeling in full flavor. Can we view, Richard, therefore, his advancement of acts like the Alien and Sedition Acts as much a manifestation of personal pique and jealousy as of any political argument? There seems to be something of that quality in it.
Well, you know, scholars have, I think, looked at this period with a somewhat jaundiced eye. They've taken these vitriolic statements by the various publishers and by the politicians themselves and discounted the vitriol as rhetoric and just a lot of speech-making. But in fact, the vitriol, the passion, reflected the enormity of the issues that these people saw.
Exactly.
And really, I would say it's the fault of the historical community not to appreciate what issues were involved. I mean, during the time of this book, the late 1790s, the United States was going to decide what the revolution had been fought for. What did American freedom mean? Did American freedom mean merely freedom from Britain, meaning independence? Or did the freedom that the United States had fought for, was it really one of the traditional British freedoms, like the freedom not to be taxed without representation, which really a property right under the British Constitution?
Right.
Or was it a completely new freedom, the freedom of democracy, meaning equal political rights regardless of wealth or property? That definition of the freedom for which the American Revolution had the freedom not to be taxed without representation, which really a property right under the British Constitution,
right.
Or was it a completely new freedom, the freedom of democracy, meaning equal political rights regardless of wealth or property? That definition of the freedom for which the American Revolution had been fought was to be decided in the late 1790s, and that issue is what made the vitriol not merely purposeless but rather meaningful, and that's why this book has the effect on the reader it has of discovering some American history they didn't know existed before.
And discovering the passion that went with it, I think that is an extraordinary contribution, because these arguments, when you read them from the sources as the book provides us, have an almost theological quality. I mean, people really vested their lives and their persons in these kinds of arguments. Turning directly to these acts, these astounding acts, the Alien Act and the Sedition Act, that Adams succeeded in having passed through the Congress in the 1790s. The first one, Richard, the Alien Act. Now, as I understand it, it raised the residency requirement for foreigners who wish to become Americans from 4 to 14 years. But is it a fact that its real target were people like William Duane and others, Irish, British, and other immigrants to this country, who were themselves radical advocates of democratic freedom?
Well, certainly that's the case. The war between Britain and France as part of the French Revolution began in 1793, and at that time a lot of people who favored the French Revolution in Britain, meaning in Ireland and in England and Wales and Scotland, they opposed George III, and they became victims of the British Sedition Act, and they ended up fleeing to the United States. And 5 years later, which is actually the period of time that one had to reside in the United States to become a citizen, was up in 1798. And so, in fact, what Adams did was, through this Naturalization Act, the first of the so-called Alien Acts, he extended the time from 5 to 14 years. And I think it's fair to say that these exiles, if you will, from abroad, who were coming to the United States to write the same kind of editorials against the threat of monarchy, against the British attack on France, in favor of the French Revolution, the democracy that the French Revolution promised, as an expression of American democracy in their view, if it wasn't the view of Adams and Washington and the Federalists, it was certainly the view of Democratic Republicans in the late 1790s right. in the United States, that the French Revolution represented the American hope for democracy as expressed through its revolution. Of course, the Federalists didn't see the American Revolution quite that way. Nevertheless, these people were going to write the same kind of stuff they wrote in Britain against monarchy, and it's clear that Adams and the Federalists wanted this kind of popular democratic voice to be quieted.
You know, when you read the Sedition Act, which was aimed at the press and aimed at criticism of the government, it's an astounding piece of legislation. Dozens of individuals recounted in the book paid the price, were indicted and imprisoned because they had violated it. Benjamin Beach himself would die, I think, awaiting trial on sedition charges. But I guess I'm amazed, Richard, that the American Congress would, even at that time, so willingly back an act that flies in the face of the Constitution itself, so recently signed.
Well, you could be no more surprised than I was in reading all this period, and when you read the anger of Democratic Republicans who are facing this very repressive piece of legislation which closed many American newspapers, opposition newspapers, which jailed many editors, even a U.S. congressman, and in fact fined people for even making a joke about the president. This was a horrendous piece of legislation, and one that ultimately cost John Adams the election of 1800.
Exactly. The story does have in its end a happy outcome. Before we get there, though, and through the course of this book, one of its other great contributions, I thought, was the very different and often quite critical perspective that this book, obviously written by the people who wrote in that time, casts upon some of our venerated figures. George Washington comes to mind. He emerges, to put it mildly, Richard, as a far less admirable figure in the pages of this book than he has come to be in national mythology. How do you feel about that characterization? Were you surprised as you read the quite rampant criticism of his action both as a general and as president?
Well, as I said, I when I began to write the book, I was going to write a book about civil liberties, and I discovered that Franklin's grandson was the object of all these attacks by Washington and Adams, and I came across a letter from Adams saying that, in fact, Franklin's grandson was carrying on the vision of his grandfather, though Benjamin Franklin had been dead since 1790. And I began to look into what this grandson was saying, and the grandson's version of the American Revolution, and wondered whether this could be Franklin's version. And this version, this Democratic Republican version that the grandson represented and that really Franklin represented, is a completely different history of the United States than we have all learned in school. It's not the story of the United States from a sort of modified Federalist perspective. It's rather the history of the United States from the point of view who wanted this country to be a democracy and lost. People who wanted to have a constitution of equal political rights for rich and poor, and found themselves in the 1790s with a constitution which mimicked the British Constitution and which, in fact, was favoring the rich. And when this group of people would look to their heroes as to the Founding Fathers, who were Democrats, particularly, for example, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine, and they would see the others, Hamilton and Adams and Washington, the Federalists, as lesser figures, undemocratic figures, and they would not tell the history of the American Revolution, and they didn't tell the history of the American Revolution as though Washington and Adams and Hamilton were heroes. In fact, from their point of view, the great hero of the American Revolution was Benjamin Franklin, who got France into the American Revolution, without which Washington's incompetence as a general, at least according to the writings of these Democratic Republicans, would have lost the American Revolution, and that Franklin and France were the heroes. And given their view, you can understand how terribly upset they were in the late 1790s to find that Washington and Adams and Hamilton were preparing to go to war against France, favoring Britain against France, in a war between the British monarch, our former enemy, and the new Democratic Republic of France, which had a revolution which mimicked the American Revolution, mm-hmm. in their view. So this whole issue of what was the true history of the American Revolution came to the forefront in the late 1790s, and pamphlets were written by Thomas Paine and Benjamin Bache and William Duane and others, which began to go back over the American Revolution and examine Washington's conduct as general to say that he was sorely deficient and that his reputation was a myth. And what American Aurora does, my book does, is to go back and take those pamphlets and take those writings, that retelling of American history, and go back and say, well, what evidence is there for this Democratic-Republican point of view? How can I substantiate what Payne and Bache and Duane and Callender and others were saying about Washington and Adams, that Adams really wanted to have a king and that Hamilton really wanted to have a king, and that Washington was totally incompetent, who would have lost the Revolution had Franklin not gotten France in? And of course, the middle section of American Aurora is an attempt to give what evidence there is for the Democratic-Republican point of view. It is, in effect, the sedition trial that Bache never had, because he died before his sedition trial. He was indicted by Adams, and he was going to face, a month right. after he died, he was going to face a trial and imprisonment for criticizing the president. So, in effect, American Aurora gives Bache the sedition trial he never had to take his most heinous arguments against Washington and Adams and say, is it possible that this vision of American history is the correct one? Can it be substantiated? And I endeavor to produce the evidence, such as it is, to support these editors, since my book is from their point of view.
That indeed it is. Let me take a moment away from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Richard Rosenfeld, author of American Aurora, published by St. Martin's Press. Richard, as you have pointed out, the figure in this book, to this reader's eyes, who gains immensely in heroic stature as really, I would submit, the father of American democracy, is Benjamin Franklin. And one of the ways he does that, of course, is to forge the alliance with France that was so fundamentally important to this country's winning the Revolutionary War. This, I think, is a matter that is not, well, certainly not much commented upon these days, and perhaps not much understood. But would you say that the French contribution to our Revolutionary War effort was so fundamental that without it we might have lost entirely?
Well, it's very difficult to predict the course of the war. Certainly we had not been winning anything until the France entered the war. I'd like, actually, George, there are a variety of things I could say with respect to your last comments. Maybe I should start with the idea of Benjamin Franklin as the father of the country. I gave a talk before the Franklin Papers people at Yale, friends of Benjamin Franklin's papers at Yale, in which I pointed out that the image that Americans have of Benjamin Franklin is kind of an avuncular humorist and a tinkerer and an inventor and perhaps a womanizer and a very smooth diplomat. Those images, upon which many scholars have built, are really images that were created about Franklin by his enemies in the 1790s, by the Federalists, who wanted to discredit Franklin, discredit his contribution to the American Revolution, and make him a lesser figure, and were successful in so doing in terms of the way history is taught today. And the reason they wanted to diminish Franklin's and belittle Franklin's image in the American mind is because Franklin was the foremost Democrat in America. He didn't want a constitution of the sort we have today. Benjamin Franklin wanted a much more simple parliamentary system with a single chamber legislation, a legislature with a very large chamber, 5,000 people to elect each representative for only 1 year, very responsive to the people, and that chamber would elect a plural executive, an executive council to administer the laws, again, answerable to that chamber. That is not what America's Federalists wanted. That's not what the people who designed our Constitution wanted. Mm-hmm. They wanted a Constitution which would protect people of property against that kind of democracy, and they designed a different system. So that when the war concluded, a great effort was made by people like John Adams and others to diminish Franklin's reputation. So this book attempts to explain all that, to explain, right. to give a new perspective of Franklin, mm-hmm. that who the true Franklin was, why Federalists would have an interest in diminishing his image in our eyes, and then going back to look at the who George Washington really was, because right. the reason, if we told the American Revolution as a story of the French having saved the United States from England, we would be doing many things. For one thing, we would say that we as a Protestant nation owed our independence, from a Protestant king to a Catholic nation. That was a very uncomfortable thing at that time to say. But more than that, we would say that if really France won the American Revolution and not Washington, then the man who got France into the American Revolution, Benjamin Franklin, becomes the father of our country.
Well, you know, it's something that I find extremely interesting because I must confess I was one of the people who shared that avuncular vision of Benjamin Franklin. I can see him now with his kite, you know, pulling electricity down, Poor Richard's Almanac, and all of that. But I think what the book does is restore his stature as the philosopher, if you will, whose ideas really are the central ideas of popular democracy. You know, I thought it extremely ironic, if I understood it correctly, that the help he secured from a French king, Louis XVI, in helping this country would, in a kind of an odd way, and I won't say it was the entire reason, but it certainly played into it, play back into the very revolution that convulsed France some years after our own. In other words, the ideas and the symbols of the American success in Revolutionary War must have had some play out in the fate which befell that very king, Louis XVI, and his regime.
Well, when John Adams arrived in Paris in 1778, he heard from the foreign minister, Vergennes, that the France and the king, or I should say the king and the ministry and the government people would have been compelled to sign an alliance with the United States regardless of whether they wanted it or not. So popular was the United States in France.
Huh.
And and you know, in the end, of course, despite the advice of his finance minister Necker and others, that in fact a prolonged help for the United States Revolution against Britain would might jeopardize France and jeopardize its finances. Nevertheless, though France engaged in a massive amount of help to the United States, with the result that it tripled, in effect, its national debt, and which of course is what caused the great crisis in France, which caused Louis XVI to call in the Third Estate, the ordinary people, to Paris in order to deliberate on new taxes, which this debt necessitated, and which of course gave these ordinary people the opportunity for the first time in hundreds of years to express themselves directly together before the king and create the democratic revolution that we call the French Revolution. So that, yes, in fact, that extraordinary effort by France, at, inspired by Benjamin Franklin, did bring down the king.
You know, the book has many flavors. It reads in many ways like a novel, like a history book. It also has some elements of mystery, which I certainly won't reveal now, but come into play, particularly in the third section of the book. What I do want to turn our attention to now is the unveiling of this amazing story in America we've been focusing on, and that, of course, is the play out of the 1790s, which, despite Mr. Adams' efforts, despite the Alien and Sedition Laws, despite the Federalist fervor, ends with the triumph of Thomas Jefferson, who wins election as America's third president and succeeds John Adams. And I'm wondering, can we interpret the victory of Thomas Jefferson as really a kind of victory for Benjamin Franklin, a kind of a vindication of his ideas?
Well, I think so. That one of the things that I hope I got a letter from the President of the United States in this book, and he's reading it, and he says that everybody in the White House is reading it. What I hope this book will do is to make clear that really the true father of democracy in this country is not Thomas Jefferson, but Benjamin Franklin. The people who elected Thomas Jefferson president, the people he credits making him president, people like William Duane and Benjamin Beasley, the editors of the Aurora, and people like James Thompson Callender and radical Democratic Republicans, these men were not followers of Jefferson's. They were followers of Franklin. They had Franklin's vision, Franklin was their hero. If you had asked, in fact, Thomas Jefferson who the father of the country was, if you had asked him who was the great American, he would not have said George Washington or John Adams or Alexander Hamilton. Thomas Jefferson would have said the greatest man of the United States to that point, and the most important man to the United States to that point was clearly Benjamin Franklin. So that, the democracy we enjoy today starts with a Franklinian vision. It goes all the way back long before to the very beginning of the Revolution. I think it's important for us to reconsider Franklin's role in relationship to Jeffersonian democracy, which is really a brand of Franklinian democracy.
Richard, a comment and then a concluding question. The comment is, the book was so persuasive in reintroducing Benjamin Franklin to me that I'm currently reading his autobiography, and I want to thank you for that. And here's the concluding question for this conversation, Richard Rosenfeld. It seems to me that this extraordinary tale, told from its original sources as you have done, is very much a cautionary tale in many ways. I mentioned at the outset unsung heroes we haven't had a chance to touch upon, but among them I would first of all cite the printers and the newspaper people of that era and their dedication to the First Amendment. You are yourself the descendant of printers, so I just wonder if I asked you to sort of very briefly point out what you thought the pith of the cautionary moment in this story is, what would you say to those of us living and reading today?
Well, I think that the election of Thomas Jefferson in the face of acts which we would regard as unconstitutional, the Alien and Sedition Acts, was not the result of Jefferson's leadership. It was the result of the leadership of Democratic Republicans who are newspaper publishers who stood up to the administration at the risk of imprisonment. Many of them were imprisoned and caught the attention of the American people and let the American people understand that the kind of behavior that required control of thought, control of religion, control of speech was monarchical. We might use the word totalitarian today, but was monarchical. And they were the heroes, the press were the heroes, and that is really the tale here. Jefferson retired to Virginia when things got sort of hot in June of 1798. It was the newspaper people who stayed, who fought, who published, and this book was intended to be a story of the First Amendment. It ends up as a story of the First Amendment and how critical that is to the workings of our democracy.
Richard Rosenfeld, thank you very, very much for being with us on Dialogue today. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Richard Rosenfeld, author of American Aurora, published by St. Martin's Press. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistants are Jennifer Kilo and Mark Rothke. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.